You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalists. I am Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this is being recorded on the evening of October 26, 2024. I have to note before I get started that I'm going to be moving, not next week, but the week after. And so if I suddenly go incommunicado, if you don't hear a new show or something like that, that's the reason why, and I'll keep you posted as far as that goes. I want to talk about something that I haven't dealt with in any detail before, and that's the nature of modern historiography and the epistemological issues that affect it. Historiography is the actual writing of history, or more broadly, the entire process of research and presentation of a historical topic. And over the centuries, there have been schools, these interrelated scholars who share a number of assumptions about things like evidence, explanation, narrative, motive, whatever. But we also know that there's been history as long as there's been writing. We can talk about Thucydides, we can talk about St. Augustine, we can talk about Josephus before him. And most of them cited sources and many other things. Middle Ages, especially in Byzantium, had, and of course in the Renaissance, had its own version of historiography. But a school under this rubric has to bring an analysis of historical methods, research, inquiry, inference. How do we go about understanding the past? What are some of the challenges? Now, of course, everything has a history. Therefore, history is overwhelming in data. Therefore, specialization is something that's imposed on you, especially in 2024, where even in small and obscure areas of history, the English language literature is massive. So, I want to deal with some of these issues, and I want to start with Leopold von Ranke, who died in 1886, and I want to start with him because he was the first relatively contemporary figure to bring history and present it to us as a method. Now, when I was in grad school, I was in three departments: history, philosophy, and political science. The problem that I faced is now I had to learn and be equally fluent with the methods of all three of those fields, where most of my fellow grad students are doing only one. That makes me, I think, more dangerous of an opponent. And I noticed pretty early on that the lines that separate those three disciplines are very thin. Comparative politics, for example, is a historical field. Leopold von Ranke wants to bring, and he, this is not explicit, but remember, he was a professor at the University of Berlin from 1824 to German unification, 1871. He was both a theologian and a classicist. He even was the court historiographer of the Prussian court. Not necessarily in the way they wanted. And he was also a dedicated Protestant. His main works, The History of the Reformation in Germany, which came out in 1854, and The History of the Latin and Teutonic Nations, what we would call the early modern period, and that came out in before that in 1824. So things like history, time, truth, these were massive issues. The Enlightenment had petered out with the French Revolution, although it certainly still existed in Britain. By the time that he began writing professionally, say 1820s, Hegel was already dead. And he had a very involved philosophy of history and history of philosophy. Immanuel Kant had one too, although that's much much less well known. But even from classical Greece, you had a school, the Pyrrhonists, that there was no truth in history. It wasn't a useful discipline. Historians pick and choose what they want to do because everyone has an agenda, whether it be errors of fact and or interpretation, it doesn't matter. And by the way, the distinction between fact and interpretation is a separate issue. But so their claim was that it was not a useful discipline. Prior to Ranke, there was a lot of very bad history, and I immediately start thinking of Machiavelli, who tried to buttress all of his points by making reference to a historical event or incident, known probably to Italian intellectuals at the time, but not so much to us. But he doesn't cite sources. He doesn't, you know, this is an interpretation that he forces into his already existing political scaffolding. By the time Ranke was around, there was no agreement on what historiography meant, storytelling, documents, the nature of narrative, and all the rest, or even the role of the historian. Ranke brought history as somewhat of a scientific field. I don't mean it in terms of method. I mean it just in terms that it is logically arranged. The Enlightenment was prefaced on very bad history. Even something like the state of nature, there's no excuse for that nonsense. And he, you know, the French Revolution and Hegel put the final nails in the Enlightenment's coffin, at least on the continent. The Enlightenment always used history for their already existing preordained conclusion. They were always like Machiavelli, and then later, fast and loose with the evidence. Frankly, it was based on fraud. These guys thought that they had to use historical examples to buttress their point of view. To say that they're cherry-picking is a wild understatement. But Ranke starts off by saying that you cannot begin with an already existing universal ideal that history is designed to bring out. Despite the fact that it really, history wasn't a discipline as such at the time, you did have plenty of exceptions. I mean, the decline and fall of the Roman Empire came out in 1776, and it's quite systematic, like Thucydides was many centuries before. But it was a complex of causes, not settling on one or another. There were also antiquarians and classicists. That was their own, you know, they developed their own technique. They needed to test propositions. The early museums were forming at this point. But the farther back in history you go, the more difficult it is to put yourself in the shoes of an actor, especially in a society so totalitarian as a liberal one. Trying to tell a fake from a real document, not necessarily mean just things on paper, people and witnesses and logic, these are all documents. Text is probably a better way to put it. And textual analysis was the antiquarian ideal. Still, no unified image of the historian. So his aims are that any unifying theory, like Hegel, for example, to explain things in history or historically had to be avoided. And he wanted to put the emphasis on facts and logic. Now, of course, everyone claims to base what they do on facts and logic. Although my question usually is, what if they all point to an underlying tendency? What if it starts getting remarkable when you're reading on a topic from many different points of view? Runge wanted to rescue history from Kant and Hegel, these universal and sweeping conclusions of history. Rather, some have called it a bottom-up view. However, he was a romantic in the sense that he saw nations and civilizations, and epics really, as distinct. They're distinct from one another. You can only understand them on their own terms. The term historicism has two meanings. The first is a philosophy of history that leads to an ideology. You know, history is designed to establish British liberal capitalism all over the world. There's another historicism, which can also be this very idea of a nationalism, with each nation or linguistic group different. So Runge was what we call a Reconstructionist. But science, not speculation, has to be at the core of everything. Objectivity is difficult. The opposite of objectivity is to be present-centered. What is your motive for doing history in the first place? Is it just to justify what you already believe? In which case, you're not a historian at all. But that's very common. Being objective is very, very hard. I remember in college in Hartford, I remember the day I just finished a class and I said, you know, we talked about these issues and I said, I'm going to dedicate myself to coming up with whatever the truth happens to be, whether it be in politics or history or anything else. And whatever happens, happens. I distinctly remember it. And while it's always a struggle, I've tried to live up to that. So any investigation, though, can't start there. It has to be very cautious and scientific. Your opinion has to be grounded in facts. At the time, there were a lot of polemics, but polemical writing wasn't a valid one as far as history was concerned. Imagination has no place. The past, history is locked away in primary sources. And living in the midst of the scientific and industrial revolution, Runge talks about testing of hypotheses, but that's what induction is for. Collecting data and building conclusions from there. Not the other way around. He also thought history should focus on major events. His books, the two of them that I mentioned, things like the Reformation or an individual like John Calvin, which seems to conflict with the bottom-up conception of history, but he's talking about in a scientific sense. Ultimately, the historian's role is very minor. The only thing he does is assembles what he comes across. Constructionism is where you present the facts no matter what. And your role is just as a recorder, so to speak, and an interpreter. Deconstructionism is that the historian is almost everything, and that's just an excuse to promote whatever the trendy agenda happens to be. Runge said this, the strict presentation of facts, no matter how conditional or unattractive they might be, is undoubtedly the supreme law of historiography. Say only what you can verify. And that includes motives, not just events. Interpretation, of course, is just as real as collecting facts. If history was just collecting facts and dates, I wouldn't be doing it. Interpretation is a different matter, but it can't deviate from the sources you have at your disposal. And Runge, from then on, dominated historical practice. Understanding the uniqueness of language groups, nations, and civilizations, the difficulty of objectivity, basing your interpretation on things that you have already gone over, and of course, importantly, the interrogation of sources. So he oversaw the professionalism of history. So I think the basics there are clear. Runge was part of the continental tradition of historiography, or of doing history. And one of the key assumptions, say in Vico's New Science from 1725, it's an interpretation of history that centered on the idea of a universal, static human nature. So the big issue is whether or not this nature exists and what form does it take. Because if there's a single human nature, there has to be an underlying universal history. Vico talks about, and this was a 18th, 19th century phenomenon. Vico was one of these guys who really did a scientific approach to history as much as was possible at the time. And of course, the sources that they had available were far smaller than what we have. But Vico's interpretation of history is on civilizations. And since there's an underlying uniformity in human nature across epochs and nations, then so long as you understand those and the environment in which this human nature is situated, you can figure out what people did and why. His concern was the development of interrelated social areas, civil society, law, government. In other words, universal humanity faced with recurring challenges will produce the same set of responses at least over time. Now, that makes history pretty easy, but it's a little bit more complicated than that. It's this, the stages. I did an entire lecture on Danilevsky and Leontiev's conception of every civilization, although they can only be understood internally, externally, they go through three stages. This primitive unity, the flowering of complexity, and then the decay of that into now a complex unity again. And it doesn't matter where any people are from, a civilization or a society goes through those three phases. Johann Herder, who I've also spoken of at great length, does not accept the human nature idea, or at least not in the way that it's expressed. Human nature, you know, these are tendencies. We have the reasoning faculty, the will, etc. But how detailed is this identical human nature? I mean, Aristotle said that man is a reasoning animal. Is that deep enough, as a description of human nature? But Herder was a nationalist, one of the founders of nationalist political thought, especially in his ideas for the philosophy of history of humanity, which came out in 1791. It's a historicized and enculturated conception of human nature, that human nature itself is a product of language, or at least a historical product, and that recurring challenges to any group of people will not see the same responses. The historicist philosophy of human nature, you see in Hegel and even Nietzsche later on, Herder set the stage for it. The social construction of human nature and social identity. That there is no objective truth, there's only intersubjective truth within a nation. Now, philosophy have always raised questions about the totality of history. It's not uncommon to find this large organizing schema or meaning to be found in it. They want to make an effort to demonstrate how history enacts a certain divine order, or reveals a certain cyclical pattern, or plays out over time an important theme like Hegel's freedom. The point is that the contingency and arbitrariness of historical events is only on the surface. And this basically is called the hermeneutic school, interpretation of large historical features rather than individuals, contextualized or not. It treats the whole sweep of history as a complicated but orderly text. The interpreter will always assign meaning to some elements in order to fit these elements into the larger themes and motifs of whatever the narrative is. Ranke makes this point explicitly in 1881 and condemns it. One of the clearest is theodicy, the religious attempt to deal with the problem of evil. St. Augustine was one of these, where it was an attempt to find meaning and structure in Roman history by relating the past, and again, he's focused on Rome, and of course his own day, into some overarching divinely ordained plan. And the more general it is, the easier it is to argue it. As early as 1709, Leibniz's theodicy. Of course, the very concept of theodicy is to explain evil, and he said that evil is not real. Or I shouldn't say evil, I should say bad things, suffering. That everything good is a struggle and is a battle. You just don't see it in the light of history, the light of eternity. You're seeing it just as an experience right now. And Leibniz, his goal was to connect the tragedies of history and make those tragedies compatible with an all-good, all-knowing, and all-powerful God. I never thought that was particularly hard to do, because to challenge that is to say, I want God to create utopia for me. Which is why stop at suffering, anything negative, which of course would destroy freedom. And as Dostoevsky would say, people would simply get bored. Any good God is going to allow room for free will. But the Enlightenment in general, and Vico is an exception, the Enlightenment idea rejected any religious interpretation of history. That doesn't mean that history to them didn't have an end. But that end was brought about by something called progress. The idea that humanity is moving in the direction of a better and more perfect civilization. And the study of the history of civilizations will bring this out if you study it properly. And of course, that implies, though, that there's a good that we know right now that is slowly being manifest over time. And that is not a historical question. So, you know, liberal democracy and capitalism in the famous American Exceptional History from Francis Fukuyama, things like capitalism and liberal parliamentarism, those are outside of history. Those are good no matter what. But history is how this can be imposed throughout the world. And not only is that an important philosophy of history, it also informs the State Department and even the Pentagon today. Trust me, history is a weapon. It's one of the three dominant original fields, history, theology, and philosophy. But someone like Vico, you know, different civilizations go through the same stages. And therefore, there is a conception of progress there. People like Rousseau and Kant talked about these goods that are being brought about by historical struggles. Adam Smith, this tremendous optimism about the progressive effects of rationality in the unfolding of his Scottish and British economic system. Hegel's philosophy of history, which is the realization of a specific enculturated freedom within the state. Karl Marx, of course, is very obvious, because he's talking about the conditions for the emancipation of labor within an industrial context. Now, there's something called meta-historians, and I think you guys know what I'm talking about. It's a macro interpretation, order to world history. Spengler. It's a clear example. Toynbee, Wittfogel, Lattimore, Eric Voegelin. They offer a broad reading of world history relative to the rise and fall of civilizations. It's not so much inspired by philosophical theory. Spengler and Toynbee portrayed human history as a coherent process in which civilizations, no matter where they might be found, pass through the specific stages of youth, maturity, and old age. Wittfogel and Lattimore both specialists in Asia, interpreted Asian civilizations using the same method, with Fogel arguing that China's history is cyclical, not directional. Lattimore talked about the geographic and ecological determinism as far as the Asian civilization is concerned. But of course, that's not the only causal factor. I've said that the Russian monarchy, for example, in the northern parts of the country, grew there because, among other reasons, you had a short growing season and poor crop yields given the nature of the soil there. Therefore, a strong central power is necessary, especially when it's so large. So there really isn't anyone, at least that's dominant, that wants to interpret the sweep of history without meaning or purpose. And this is enforced, as you well know, at the academic level. And history, almost by its very structure, is academic in a full-time job. The claim that there's some agency lying behind historical events, that historical events are bringing out, and it's an error in this empirical or positivist approach to try to find meaning behind the features of certain events, say the terror relative to the French Revolution. So Vico, Spengler, Toynbee, they are vulnerable to certain criticisms. My own is that their sweeping understanding of nations and civilizations are really just slogans. Doesn't mean what they're saying isn't true. There's only so much you can write. Vogelin is particularly bad here, although I'm a great admirer of his. Many of the writers, like, you know, Spengler, Vogelin, they have a monocausal interpretation that there's one thing that is both necessary and sufficient for historical development. They take out a single factor, and that drives history. Universal human nature, like in Vico, or a common set of challenges facing all civilizations, Spengler, Toynbee, Leontief, Danilevsky, Vogelin. And the only way to evaluate this is based on concrete historical evidence. But there's meaning in history given the leftist ascendancy in academia. They did everything they could to get rid of any kind of providential understanding of history, the Augustinian sense of history. But the only reason they do that is to substitute their own. We read history, we see embodied a substantial degree of contingency and freedom. That is, multiple paths to development. Now, of course, there's plenty of credible, great historical interpretations. But for any proposition, no matter how great it is, no matter how large it is, universal it is, it still has to be checked through logic. Immanuel Kant, and I'd be remiss if I don't mention Kant and Hegel here. Kant wasn't a professional historian, neither was Hegel. Kant applied philosophy to historical ideas. His philosophy of history is political. And essentially, he wants to create a European civic state globally, a single civic order. And he wrote this in his 1784 Idea for a Universal History from a Cosmopolitan Point of View. And he says this. It's not a long book and easy compared to his other stuff. He says, the greatest problem for the human race, to the solution of which nature drives man, is the achievement of a universal civic society which administers law among men. The history of mankind can be seen, by and large, as a realization of nature's secret plan to bring forth a perfectly constituted state as the only condition in which the capacities of mankind can be fully developed, and also bring forth that external relation among states which is perfectly adequate to this end. In other words, if you have law and order at the national level, there should be at the international level. Nations then take the place of individuals. So nature, which he always spells with a capital N, and this is very different from his earlier work, the point of nature, and hence historical progress, is the development of all the capacities which humanity can reach. But those things can only be attained in a functional society. Freedom has to be present. The definitions of freedom and the limits to freedom have to be clear and simple to be consistent with the freedom of others. Opposition is a good thing because it lays out these very definitions. And this is a destiny. Again, very different from Kant's metaphysics and epistemology. So Kant says a society in which freedom under external laws, that is the rule of law, is associated in the highest degree with irresistible power. Now, how he knew that in 1784, and of course 1784 is prior to the French Revolution, but that is what Kant says is the highest problem nature assigns to the human race. Men love their boundless freedom, but it's necessity that brings them to constraint. They're forced by the greatest of all needs, the control of their passion. A civic union, that is, a modern state, can solve this. It's like trees in a forest, Kant says. Each one needs the others, since each, in seeking to take the air and sunlight from others, has to constantly push itself to strive upward. And that's where these great trees come from. Isolated trees rarely survive. Or if they do, they're stunted and crooked and everything else. Kant also says, though, and I want to quote him again from the same book, that I would want to displace the work of practicing empirical historians with this idea of world history, which is to some extent based on an a priori principle, would be misinterpretation of my intention. It is only a suggestion of what a philosophical mind, which would have to be well-versed in history, could essay from another point of view. Otherwise, the notorious complexity of the history of our time must naturally lead to serious doubt as to how our descendants will begin to grasp the burden of the history we shall leave to them after a few centuries. So he's claiming this is a philosophical question, not a historical one, despite the fact that he uses nature and history very similarly. This is something that history is destined to produce. Now, I don't have a whole lot of time to get into Hegel. I have many lectures and writings on Hegel. But Hegel's probably the most fully developed modern philosophical theory on history, specifically the meaning and direction of it. Hegel and Marx, although they're complete opposites of each other, they regard history as an intelligible process moving towards a specific condition, the realization of human freedom within the well-ordered state. And Hegel himself says, the question at issue is therefore the ultimate end of mankind, the end which the spirit sets itself in the world. And by end, he means purpose. No one really was so historically minded as a philosopher as Hegel was. That there is an objective history, objectively true, but there's also the subjective development of the individual consciousness or spirit. But that connection is close. It's an intimate one. And this is the historical aspect of the phenomenology of spirit in 1807. He says that it's a central task of philosophy to understand its place in this very unfolding. Hegel says, history is the process whereby the spirit discovers itself and its own concept. So he constructs this global history, mostly European, into stages of freedom, more or less realized. The public freedom of the polis in classical Greece, to the Roman Republic and its citizenship, the individual freedom of the Reformation, to the civic and ethnic freedom of the modern state. Now, he tries to talk about India and China, but he sees them largely as prehistorical or ahistorical. He accepts the great man thesis that great men, especially conquerors, bring about a radical change in society. So, for example, Napoleon conquered much of continental Europe. Hegel says that's a world historical event. It's actually doing history's work because the end goal of Napoleon's conquest is to bring about a revolutionary, rational, bureaucratic state. Hegel, of course, is vehemently opposed to the French Revolution. There's a latent reason found in history. Now, this isn't just an exercise of speculative philosophical reasoning. It's not all a priori. And he does talk about interpreting specific historical developments. But what matters with Hegel is he's proposing an imminent encounter between philosophical reason and any historical reality. Philosopher of history, W.H. Walsh, we're going to talk about him more in a minute. This is how he explains it, the Hegelian conception of history. To accomplish this task, the philosopher must take the results of empirical history as data, but it will not suffice for him merely to reproduce them. He must try to illuminate history by bringing his knowledge of the idea, the formal articulation of reason, to bear upon it, striving, in a phrase Hegel uses elsewhere, to elevate empirical contents to the rank of necessary truth. In other words, data isn't self-interpreting. Data tends to be a complex thing. It's not just a catalog of events. There has to be another purpose to it. Raising brute facts to the rank of necessary, not contingent, truth. I mentioned the hermeneutics, the hermeneutic school of historical interpretation. Hermeneutics is just a very fancy word. It refers to reading books. It's a close reading of texts, and he's talking about words on a page, although not exclusively, that the core of human interaction is linguistic and symbolic. One of the leaders of this field was Wilhelm Dilthey, who died in 1911. He maintained that the social sciences, what he calls the human sciences, were inherently different from the natural sciences. Because the human sciences depend on the understanding of meaningful human actions and free will. But natural science, science in the sense that we usually use the term, there's no intention there. It's an explanation of non-intentional states. Human life is structured. It's meaningful action and symbolic expression. That is, this is all social. The interpretation of meaningful texts, these are suited to the interpretation of human action and history. And he makes an entire method out of this approach. But this isn't just a historical problem. Dilthey talks about establishing integral relations to all the theoretical disciplines dealing with social life. The boundaries between things like political science and economics and literature, not to mention all the social sciences, all of this, they have more in common than they do. They're just looking at the same thing from different points of view. Dilthey called at least early on in his career, said that philosophy is the experiential science of spiritual phenomena, to cognize the laws governing social, intellectual, and moral phenomena. And this comes from Dilthey's lecture in 1867. He became a professor at Basel in Switzerland. But you could find this in other writings as well. He wants to lay out a theory on the basis of psychological laws and impulses where art, religion, and science all derive. So any intellectual system is just a crystallization of more generic schemata rooted in life, and that is psychological. Like Hegel, you have the objective data of history and how it's manifest and understood by individuals, psychologically speaking. Now, Dilthey did believe that over time, history can arrive at lawful explanations. In other words, non-contingent causes, logically certain causes, like, the natural sciences claim to do. Part of that is that he thought that the inner emotional content of historical actors can be understood. And he actually says this in his Poetics. And these laws of hermeneutics, he summarizes as the laws of exclusion, intensification, and completion. So even in regular experience, images are always transformed because we never look at it as a gestalt. We exclude what doesn't interest us, and then we intensify what remains based on our present interests. Now, poetic imagery is different. It's completed by the overall life concern of the great, powerful intellectual psyche. Now, later on, he thought that the psychic nexus was not strong enough for this. But he does see it collectively embedded in any social world. He says that our access to history is much more direct than our access to nature. Remember, he's writing the turn of the century. Nature seems foreign, but we are a part of history. Objects of our external experience are phenomena. In other words, they're not solid data. But he also rejects internal experience being phenomenal. Internal experience is reconceived as a lived experience, and it relates us to history. So the human sciences, including history, is about the meaning of human action and interaction. In 1890, he wrote an article called The Origin of Our Belief in the Reality of the External World and Its Justification. And he says, any access we have to the external world, the world around us, it's not a matter of inference, but we understand it as real because it resists our will. Lived experience isn't just a phenomenon. It's present to us and is shown to us, embodying already existing values. We can't help but, in any image, be attracted by some things and not others. But something in turn has to cause that. Now, a very different line of interpretation in the 20th century, Heidegger, Gadamer, etc. We'll talk about postmodernism if we have time. History has to be understood from the point of view of meaning and language. Historical knowledge, again, depends on the interpretation of what is considered meaningful human action and practice. We talked about this at length with Heidegger. Probing things, historical realities, trying to discover their interconnections of meaning. That's the purpose of history here. Now, something else happened in the 20th century, and that is World War I and II. Progress wasn't talked about very much when the cream of European manhood from 1914 to 1945 was slaughtered. The First World War, there doesn't seem to be any real reason for it, except to save the British sense of superiority. Things like existentialism and certain forms of Marxism were influenced by this search for meaning. Though we all know the ideological content of this was already laid out. The Soviet Union was the wave of the future. And I call this a memory, the representation of a memory, racial or national identity. It's amazing how Darwinism survived the discovery of DNA. One of the things, or several things that these guys will never talk about, no matter whether they be analytic or continental, is money, influence, and threats of violence to the historian, let alone the people who the historian deals with. The in-group mentality and what can be done to outsiders. Certain things that cannot be mentioned or talked about. Can you be a historian in that circumstance? Another hermeneutic understanding comes from R.G. Collingwood. He's talking about specifying historical content, and of course that history is constituted by human behavior. And this behavior, these actions, are the result of deliberation and choice from the available alternatives. So this has to be explained. You have to be able to reconstruct the thought process of any historical actor, or else you're not going to know anything. One of the ways to discover a forgery in historical writing is that rulers will not condemn themselves. Like stuff like the protocols where these alleged elders of Zion refer to themselves as evil, that we're going to destroy this and destroy that. That's not what people say about themselves. The only exception to that is Hitler, according to contemporary mind. And that's one of the things you can't talk about. But this is about reconstruction of thought, their state of mind and their intention. You know, monarchs and generals and emperors. So he talks about reenactment. And he's talking about Plato's meanings as a philosopher or Caesar's intentions as a ruler. And he says this in 1946. This reenactment is only accomplished in the case of Plato and Caesar, respectively, so far as the historian brings to bear on the problem all the powers of his own mind and all his knowledge of philosophy and politics. It is not a passive surrender to the spell of another's mind. It is a labor of active and therefore critical thought. His philosophy of history is that the historical past is not restated, but it's reenacted. It's not to say that a past event occurred, like a scientist predicting a solar eclipse. We're talking about free will and the soul, therefore we're talking about the thoughts and motivations of historical actors. Collingwood claims that you can have the same thoughts as an agent that you're studying, so long as you know the context. Now, his point is that when a historian will reenact something in his mind, he's talking about the propositional content of thought. That's just thought in his mind. It has to be a proposition, it has to be about something. But that's different from acts of thinking. Those he refers to as sensations or feelings. But when we're talking about individuals, that criterion of identity doesn't exist with thinking. Acts of thinking are individuated. They occur by different people at different times. But thoughts, that is to say, propositional content, it doesn't make any difference. If two people mention the syllogism, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal, they entertain one and the same thought shared among them. Now, let's move into the Anglo-American morass. Since the fall of the Berlin Wall and the transition into the 21st century, this has been precisely a morass. The Anglo-American idea of history refused, allegedly, to talk about speculative philosophy. Of course, Fukuyama is an exception. They generally question logic and epistemology of what counts as historical knowledge. One of the great founders of this was David Hume in his History of England, which he started in 1754. And his interpretation dealt with ordinary actions, motives, and causes, rejecting any spiritual element, which seems to be awfully hasty. You have to be open to these things as possibilities. And in his mind, he does accept a fixed human nature, and explanations of the past can be based on that, and therefore are more or less correct. Middle of the 20th century, the interest was in the characteristics of historical knowledge, facts from non-facts. What constitutes a good historical explanation? But this is connected with analytic philosophy, the empirical and scientific status of historical knowledge, whatever that might mean. These people are skeptical about the power of non-empirical reason when coming to conclusions about the structure of the world, including history. Reasoning by itself can't be a source of real knowledge about the natural world or anything else. That kind of knowledge can only come from empirical inductive investigation and then logical analysis afterwards. But that's a slogan. It doesn't mean much because data has to be grounded. That was Hegel's whole purpose. The danger is that this ideologization of history is so ingrained that they mistake imposing this on the world with scientific fact. And this is particularly the case under our present regime of censorship. Any historian, let's assume he's using Google and university libraries, is only a small percentage of the available documents are available to him. Anything else is cast into the outer darkness. In 1951, and it was republished in 1960, The Philosophy of History was a book by W.H. Walsh. And he wants to deal with the philosophy of history and the nature of historical knowledge. Now, Walsh is a philosopher, not a straight-out historian, but he was heavily influenced by Collingwood. He makes a distinction between critical and speculative philosophy of history. And he wants to propose a framework the main questions about history can be addressed. The historian is presented with a number of events, actions, and developments during a specific period, what he's studying. Our job is to discover what makes them coherent, what makes them hang together, so to speak. He coined his own neologism, a term called colligation. That means, and he defines it as, to locate a historical event in a larger historical process in terms of which it makes sense. This process of reasoning serves to establish the interconnections between certain historical events. Now, I don't know why you need a new word for that. That's something that I do every day. And like Collingwood, Walsh accepts the idea that history concerns conscious human action and hence the free will. History is a science of the mind. Both Collingwood and Walsh accept that. So the key task of the historian is to reconstruct reasons, motives, in other words, that actors have had at different points in history, and the causes of those very same reasons or motives. And this is not that far away from the hermeneutics, especially in the German tradition. He sees history as something falling between the philosophy of nature and the philosophy of science. Metaphysical questions about the reality of history as a whole have to be asked, but also with the epistemic issues that arise in pursuit of historical knowledge. That's what he calls speculative. So his speculative conception is the philosophy of nature, and critical deals with the philosophy of science and the key questions for each one of them. Speculative philosophy or history asks about the meaning and purpose of the historical process as such. That's speculation. Critical philosophy of history is the equivalent for history what the philosophy of science is for nature. Well, let me quote Walsh directly here. The historian aims at a reconstruction of the past which is both intelligent and intelligible. What every historian seeks for is not a bare recital of unconnected facts, but a smooth narrative in which every event falls, as it were, into its natural place and belongs to an intelligible whole. So concerning history, Walsh says this. He says we could sum up the results of this, and he's talking about his book, this attempt to bring out the main features of the common conception of science and scientific knowledge this way. We apply the term science to knowledge that has these four. Now, I'm paraphrasing. These four features. Number one, it's methodically arrived at and systematically related. They hang together logically. They're not just a collection of facts. Number two, it consists of, or at least includes, a body of general truths. And there we're talking about axioms, the law of contradiction and stuff like that. Stuff that no one can really debate. Three, it enables us to make successful predictions and so to control the future course of events in some measure, at least. And four, it has to be objective in the sense that it is such that every unprejudiced observer ought to accept if the evidence were put before him, whatever his personal predilections or private circumstances. We live in an age of censorship. We live in an age where many questions are not allowed to be asked. And even if they were asked, the censorship makes discovering a lot of this information in these documents very difficult. I've said to this group before that I use Yandex as a search engine. Try to put something of any political importance into Google and Yandex and see what you get. They have nothing in common with each other. Also in the Anglo-American tradition, Carl Hempel, he wrote an essay in 1942 called The Function of General Laws in History. And he tried to make history as scientific as possible. He said, any explanation, if it's to be considered scientific, has to be brought under a general law. Maybe he saw historical explanation maybe as an exception, what he calls a covering law model. But it doesn't mean it's not applicable. That any valid historical explanation at least has to invoke a general law that makes sense out of it. The covering law approach. I like to think of that as the natural, the general law covers over someone's interpretation. And there was quite a bit of controversy. You know, generalizations about human nature as irrelevant. General law. Can the actions of the individual be placed writ large? Now, I've made the argument, for example, that you can have group personality disorders. I talk about projection all the time. I'm talking about the general ruling class projects its inadequacies and fears onto this other. It could be white supremacists, it could be Russia, it could be China. But what's the universal law in this case? Alan Donegan wrote in 1966 that these are more probabilistic regularities rather than universal laws, which is a clear distinction because universal law is a logical truth. You have a context of belief, and by bringing out a general law or even a probabilistic regularity is enough to cover it up. Are there real universal laws in history? I have no problem with probabilistic regularities, but this has to be situated in a context. That's all historians really care about, is context. That's why so few of them do it, at least in ideological concerns. You know, you can't talk about South African history unless you simply lie through your teeth saying that everything since 1993 has been wonderful and everything prior to that was evil. You know, I've come across, really in the social sciences, I've come across papers talking about how nationalism and national homogeneity is absolutely key for rational kids, well-adjusted kids, social trust, everything like that. And I've read all of these. There's dozens of them. That diversity is an evil, and that there is no aspect of a child's development that isn't affected by this ridiculous diversity. In fact, homogeneity creates trust in others. And they're usually falling all over themselves trying to claim, well, this doesn't support nationalism. When, of course, it's exactly what it does. So you have to just virtue signal until you're exhausted in order to get something like that published. But the claim that there's this unity of science and the logical similarity of all areas of scientific reasoning, you know, that's an error. Because you really can't pose important questions about the nature of history and historical knowledge in this case. Can you show processes which we could trace out chains of causation and even causal mechanisms without invoking universal laws, except that of causality, I guess? Let's put it this way. Any explanation of human actions should not be understood along the lines of an explanation like, I don't know, why radiators burst when it goes to 32 degrees. One is a certainty. The other is just probable. Trying to remodel the social sciences into something like physics is a joke. I think it has much to do with grant money than anything else. But trying to connect science and social science, like the behaviorists do, is an error. And it's really a lowest common denominator matter. And then there's a question of objectivity. Can we objectively represent past events? Or the opposite, that historical work ends up being dependent on our perspective. And so, you know, bias, omission, selection, whatever. And the simple fact that human actions are always laden with value, you're pursuing some good. Can a historian, or should the historian, have a non-value-laden account of these things? Of course, they don't ask where these values come from. All social action, no matter what it is, implies some conception of the good. But it's more that the historian is value-laden. His interpretations are forced upon him. Objectivity is possible, but you have to end up like me. Can any intellectual investigate the world without regard to the biases that are built into his belief system, his ideology, or his commitments to a social group? And that social group may include other historians. Is there a fixed historical world independent of any representation of the facts? Or is it intrinsically constructed? Now, I've made the claim that at least in elite circles, Russia, there is no understanding of Russia at all. Instead, it's a projection. It's a construction of what Russia and Putin are in 2024. It doesn't bear any connection to reality. And the so-called universal law that they bring it under is that everyone seeks liberal capitalism. They construct their enemy. They don't try to understand him. And that's the sort of thing that justified the mass terror bombing of civilians in Germany and Japan in 1944-45. Because there is no other point of view. Why Hitler should be absolutely off limits to any revisionism, but Stalin, no problem. Within academia itself, there was a whole Stalin revisionist movement in the 70s. But when it comes to Hitler, it's a different story. And of course, the only thing, only difference is the Jews. You know, that's your necessary and sufficient cause for some of this stuff. Now, there doesn't seem to be a real difficulty in reconciling the idea of a historian with a set of values who also will trace out those values of historical actors and historical actors possessing different ones. And it could be good, it could be bad. There's no inherent barrier that makes it impossible for such a man to examine a body of statements, behaviors, and institutions corresponding to whatever it is he's studying. You know, critical race theory, which I was had forced on me in 95 and 96 on the infamous book Words That Wound, is that whites are not allowed to talk about black history. Now, little do they know who actually is writing this history. And the one thing that you can't talk about is who owned the slave ships. That's, you know, there's a very strong argument there. There's objective facts independent of anything we want, but you simply can't talk about it because Jews, at least today, are this super phenomenal reality. So it isn't that we have epistemic values that we impart to scientists and historians. When we talk about things like intellectual discipline, the willingness to subject hypotheses to the test of uncomfortable facts, except the Holocaust, of course. But the review of the history of science and historical writing makes it apparent that these things do have effects. There are examples of historians whose conclusions are guided by their interrogation of the evidence rather than ideology. Yeah, there's plenty of examples of that. None of them are in academia, though. The question is there a representation-independent reality underlying the large historical structures to which historians commonly refer, like the Roman Empire, for example? In the Anglo-American mind, the past occurred precisely the way it occurred. New technologies invented, all the rest of it. But any of these occurrences, like a drought, for example, will leave traces of information. And that could give a rational basis for arising for arriving at beliefs about these occurrences. So there's a sense of rebellion there. Now, I've talked about language many times. The signal of a amateur is taking contemporary problems and reading them back into history, including very distant history. So let's talk about the Taiping Rebellion, 1850-1871 in China. You have to bring together a large number of historical facts and a very strong interpretive story that draws them all together in one way rather than another. But even the phrase Taiping Rebellion, well, if it's a rebellion, it seems to be chaotic. Doesn't that imply that the Chinese monarchy is legitimate and this is just a ragtag bunch of rebels? Should it be called a civil war or even a revolution instead? Did the participants believe that they were rebelling against legitimate authority? You know, can we talk about the Industrial Revolution? How abrupt was this? You know, Darwin can't be, Darwin came from the Industrial Revolution in the middle of the 19th century, or the rise of the so-called middle class, whatever that is. Karl Marx referred to labor entirely in an urban, totally deracinated context. Later on, of course, the word worker just simply referred to anyone who accepted Marxism. Now, what about causality? And the example I've been reading recently says, the American Civil War was caused by economic conflict between North and South. Now, how do you identify these things, these causes? I mean, could you have something like periods of rapid inflation, and those periods cause instability? What about necessary and sufficient conditions? How bad does it have to be? Is there a connection with how bad the economy is and the existence of civil war or rebellion? To what extent is the sufficient condition tantamount to determinism? Is the fall of the Western Roman Empire inevitable? The inevitable implies that it was a certainty and that no changes could have forestalled it. But given the configuration of those circumstances, very little would have changed it. And of course, the Eastern Roman Empire continued to function. Why did Constantine leave Rome? I mean, Western Rome. Of course, you really can't talk about that either, because Jews even play a role there. But in general, the Anglo-American point of view, although the exceptions I've just mentioned, their sense of causality comes from positivism, that philosophy of science. David Hume talked about causation as nothing but constant conjunction. So the covering law model was attractive to them because it covers over, it gives a certain legitimacy to whatever they say. And even something like behaviorism, social choice theory, just reduces everything to the simplest, almost animalistic and determined causal action. It has to apply to everybody, therefore it has to be lowest common denominator. But causal regularity are very difficult. It's very difficult to pin down. They're not universally available. So either we abandon causality, or we interpret it in a very different way. And I've already said I have no problem with probabilistic regularity. I mentioned how bad does the economy have to get before there's violence? Or is that even a relevant issue? Is it when things are getting better? Which, by the way, is true, as far as I know. It's when things are getting better and the belief in future improvement outstrips the ability of the system to actually improve. That's what causes violence, not dire poverty. So what the positivist has to say is that you're given a variable, let's say a bad economy, that was necessary for an occurrence. then we would have to say the Civil War, that economic collision between North and South, or the elites of North and South. Now, you have to provide evidence that without that economic division, the war would not have occurred. So that economic collision is, in fact, the sufficient variable, but other things have to be present too. Now, I want to switch to Leo Strauss. We've talked about Strauss and historicism before. It was a very good paper written by a mainstream conservative in 2016. Leo Strauss, Escaping the Stifling Clutches of Historicism. Now, it's all right. It has the same flaws as your typical conservative. But he deals with the rejection of the classical and Christian foundation of the Western world. Machiavelli, Hobbes, Rousseau, Nietzsche, Freud created modern ideologies in their place. Ideology takes the place of that legacy. And the main two, according to Strauss, are positivism and historicism. Strauss talked about it, and if you remember, I talked about Machiavelli's thought process using Strauss' secondary source. Machiavelli was a positivist in that he may be said to exclude dogmatically all evidence which is not ultimately derived from phenomena that are at all times open to everyone's inspection in broad daylight. Now, that's a quote directly from Strauss. Strauss says, positivism is the view according to which only scientific knowledge, as defined by modern natural science, is genuine knowledge. I think what he should have said is the contemporary scientific establishment. Because if you can't challenge Darwinism, and you can't, we're not talking about your typical scientific technique. Positivism only tries to see the obvious factual and material things and nothing else. Reliant on the scientific method. In Russia, that was the definition of nihilism prior to the revolution. Then Strauss says, positivism necessarily transforms itself into historicism. Now, what that means is that history becomes the highest authority. It's kind of the idiots who say, well, it's 2024, we can't have sexism anymore. So the typical historicism, and Strauss, of course, died in the early 70s, in the 20th century, demands that each generation reinterpret its past on the basis of its present experience and with a view to its own future. It's not a contemplative discipline. It's a matter of activism. Now, it can't end there because there has to be a reason for progress. Progress is heading towards what? Liberal capitalism, the workers' paradise. So there's things that can't be historical. You know, the American idea, Whig history, they're objectively true, according to them. Facts and institutions that progress is meant to gradually impose on the world. And Immanuel Kant is one of these people. But those goods are not historically conditioned. So historicism can only go so far. But if you are changing your point of view, given what year it is, or what epoch it is, you can't even talk about right or wrong. Or even the best social order in any kind of universal or valid way. The modern historicists were essentially sophists. Machiavelli pursued power, realism. Hobbes and Rousseau, the pursuit of the sovereign power and the general will. Nietzsche's will to power, no more than an extreme form of radical historicism, according to Strauss. And this is what happens when you reject the transcendent. The only thing they really have is a universal reality. They're down to power. As far as the ruling class is concerned, they're fine with that, because that's really all they know. So things like the historicism of Nietzsche led to existentialism. And Strauss fully agrees. Existentialism, in general, rejects the assumption that being is as such intelligible. Being doesn't exist, only power does. Each individual tries to use this against an indifferent and even hostile and certainly meaningless universe. Who's going to win? The individual is always going to lose. He doesn't have the stock of private resources necessary. And I've said many times before, we live in a highly censored mass society age, and it's on that stock of resources that people are deciding questions of heaven and hell and religion. And ultimately, it comes down to blind fate, if you want to take these, and you know, Freud is included in here too. And it leads to nihilism. And what Strauss, and he says this, he says, let us popularly define nihilism as the inability to take a stand for civilization against cannibalism. In other words, there'd be no good reason to attack cannibalism in favor of civilization. And of course, ultimately, it leads to utopianism. There are three waves of modernity, starting with Machiavelli and Hobbes, the second wave with Rousseau and Kant, and the third with Nietzsche and Freud. Piety was the Western point of view, including the Platonic point of view. I mean, there are no illusions about the perfectibility of men. That perfection is not inherent in the nature of things that we deal with every day. Problems can be alleviated, not solved. But much of contemporary ideology promises some variant of a utopia. Man, if he could conquer Fortuna, he will be the master of the universe. Hobbes, the right kind of government, would escape the limits of nature. Rousseau came right out and said man is infinitely perfectible, that there are no natural obstacles to human progress. Nietzsche even said, man is conquering nature and there are no assignable limits to that conquest. So this utopia, which brings capitalism and Marxism together, it's about man's conquest of nature for the sake of his own relief. It demands, and the scientific establishment and Darwinism demand, that man should become the master and owner of nature. This is a matter of secular redemption, not just emancipation. But this is just an ancient tyranny. We know what the left is. The left is based on deceit. That's where the left came from. It was your dagger hand. The right hand was your honest hand. It was your sword hand in Rome. You shake someone's hand with your sword hand, and your left hand grabs the dagger that he has hidden and plunges it into the guy whose hand you're shaking. It had nothing to do with the order of people in the French assembly. Or even if it did, why did it take that form? Well, I don't have enough time to get into postmodernism. But postmodernism is one of the things that comes out of this utopian way of thinking, where even things like the self and the world fall apart. And Hegel predicted this, turn of the 19th century. And postmodernism and existentialism come after, it's a post-industrial world. Instability, the localization of knowledge. There are no universal explanations. And the only universal truth is the Holocaust. Even the self isn't a single thing. Values, beliefs, words, feelings. That's all that matters. The self, the world, family, that's all in a state of flux. Language is inherently unstable. Any meta-narrative, you know, like Marxism, is rejected. There's only power in postmodernism. There's no knower, and there's no thing known. There's just phenomena. And there's no centers of reality, only centers of power. Anyway, I think I've made my point here. I had to gloss over some very difficult writers and things. But I think you get the understanding of where I fall in this and the nature of the philosophy of history and historiography. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.